This is episode 360 of Tech Talk Radio, Australia's premier tech talk show, which aired on Monday, November the 28th, 2011.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Mr. Zuckerberg, do I have your full attention?
Why would anyone trust this government not to make a complete and utter shambolic mess of the national broadband network?
Which part of time would they like us to go back to? 1960, 1930?
Can you really give that guarantee when you don't seem to know what peak speed is? I'll tell you what it is.
Okay, great. Let's give everybody a case.
The future is here.
So now technology has caught up with reality.
Ever since Telstra was privatised, Australians have suffered.
Technology has had a huge impact on our love lives.
On air, on the internet and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello everybody and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. In a move which has left some of the Tech Talk Radio panel quite bemused, five Australian ISPs have taken it upon themselves to stop their customers from downloading copyrighted content from the internet. One has to ask, since when have companies whose profit margins rely on large consumption of bandwidth taken the stance of the moral high ground? The proposal comes from discussions between ISPs, the federal government and rights holders in the movie, music, software, gaming and publishing industries. Telstra, Optus, iiNet, iPrimus, Internode, AAPT and the Internet Industry Association were involved with the Communications Alliance on the development of the scheme. According to a report in ZDNet, the proposed process involves sending education and warning notices to customers whose accounts have been undertaking activity that might infringe copyright. The scheme wouldn't terminate internet accounts and allows customers to appeal notices if they think there is no illegal activity happening on the account. Yes, you heard it right. The scheme wouldn't terminate accounts of users allegedly downloading copyrighted materials. So what's the point? Within 14 days of a potential infringement being detected, the rights holders could send a copyright infringement notice to an ISP under the scheme, stating the copyrighted work that was involved, the time it was infringed upon, and the IP address involved. The ISP would then try to match that IP address to a customer, and within 14 days would either tell the rights holder that it couldn't match the IP address or send an educational notice to the customer. The education notice would say that an infringement notice had been received and that the account may be infringing on copyright by improperly accessing content. It would say where the user could find information about piracy and how to legally source content and would warn that if the account continued to breach copyright, the rights holders could take further action. The customer then has 21 days to ponder the notice or appeal to an industry copyright panel. After that time, if another infringement notice comes through from the rights holder for the same IP address, the ISP would send a warning notice to the account holder. Again, there would be a grace period of 21 days after the account holder receives the notice before further action could be taken. Once three warning notices have been sent, if the rights holder sends through another infringement notice for the same IP address, the ISP would send a discovery notice saying that the account holder has received one educational notice and three warning notices and hasn't stopped infringing, and that the ISP would tell the rights holders after a 21-day grace period. The rights holders could then apply for access to the account holder's details by applying for a preliminary discovery or subpoena application so that the rights holders could take action with which the ISP has to comply. If an ISP receives no copyright notices for an IP address for 12 months, the process starts again, from the beginning, with an education notice.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
The tech hobby of amateur radio is experiencing a resurgence, so Robert Broomhead from the Wireless Institute of Australia joins us to tell us why. Hewlett-Packard's touchpad shipments second to iPad. The National Broadband Network takes the next step with the opening of the network's home offices in Melbourne. And desperate measures mean desperate times, as RIM is now giving away playbooks to administrators. And Adam Turner turns his attention to password security. First up, though, here's Dr. Ron with this week's news roundup from the Tech Talk Radio News Desk.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, NBN Co. opens its network operations centre in Melbourne. The EU Court of Justice says ISPs can't be forced to monitor illegal downloads. Microsoft and Novell are locked in a $1 billion antitrust lawsuit. And NASA studies environmental conditions on Mars in search of microbial life. Welcome to Tech Talk News. NBN Co. officially opened its network operations centre in Melbourne last week. The $32.5 million facility will manage the day-to-day operations of the new national broadband network. It's taken more than a year to complete and also incorporates a test facility for ISPs and network engineers, as well as an experience centre which is available for use by schools and special interest groups. Also at the launch, a 23-ton mobile discovery centre, which will tour the country with NBN customer equipment and informative interactive slideshows. The centre was officially opened by the Minister for Broadband, Communications and the Digital Economy, Senator the Honourable Stephen Conroy.
This is an exciting day in the history of the NBN. From today, the network has an official nerve centre, a heartland. The NBN's network health will be monitored and managed from right here and services tested right here.
It's expected that NBN Co's new operations centre will create more than 900 jobs by the end of 2012. In Brussels, the European Union Court of Justice last week said that internet service providers cannot be forced to block their users from downloading songs illegally, as such an order would breach EU rules. The court issued its verdict on Thursday in a case involving a Belgian society that collects music royalties and a Belgian telecommunications provider. The Royal Society had asked a Belgian court to order the telco to install a device which would prevent users from downloading copyright works. This order was granted, but the ruling was challenged last week and overturned. In its ruling, the court said EU law precludes the imposition of an injunction by a national court that requires an internet service provider to install a filtering system with a view to preventing the illegal downloading of files. The ruling went on to say the filtering system would also likely infringe the fundamental rights of customers, namely their right to protection of personal data and their right to receive or impart information. The decision will affect 24 royalty collection organisations across the 27-country European Union. Known best for its NetWare network operating system, Novell Incorporated is suing software juggernaut Microsoft for a patent infringement which dates back to 2004. Current chairman and former CEO of Microsoft, Mr. Bill Gates, has testified in the $1 billion US antitrust lawsuit centered around Windows 95 and its alleged inbuilt compatibility with Novell's WordPerfect word processor. Mr. Gates was the first witness to testify last week in the federal court in Salt Lake City and said several last-minute changes to technical features were made which would no longer support a rival software maker's word processor. Mr. Gates said these changes were made because he feared otherwise WordPerfect compatibility would crash the operating system. Mr. Gates described Windows 95 as the most challenging, trying project Microsoft had ever done. Novell says it was later forced to sell WordPerfect for a $1.2 billion US loss. Novell has conceded that Microsoft was under no legal obligation to provide advance access to Windows 95 for Novell to prepare a compatible version, but alleges that Microsoft, however, enticed Novell to work on a version, only to withdraw support months before Windows 95 hit the market. The hearing before US District Judge Frederick Motz continues this week. And NASA hopes its latest mission to Mars, the Curiosity rover, will provide evidence that Mars once had an environment favourable for microbial life. At the time of recording this week's Tech Talk News, the Mars Science Laboratory mission is still scheduled for launch on Saturday. NASA says the rover will use a laser to look inside rocks and release their gases so its spectrometer can analyse and send data back to Earth. Dr. Mary Wojtek is a microbiologist with the US Geological Survey and in charge of NASA's astrobiology program.
So we're here today discussing looking for signs of life. The game is afoot. The search is on. It's going to look for places that are habitable, either in the past or potentially even in the future or currently.
Scientists believe that 3.5 million years ago, the rocks on Earth and Mars were very similar, and learning to identify signs of life in Earth's earliest rocks has been a key part of preparations for NASA's latest mission. NASA expects for 23 months after landing, Curiosity will analyze dozens of samples drilled from rocks or scooped from the ground as it explores the Martian landscape with greater range than any previous rover. I'm Dr. Ron, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Did you hear about this, Graham?
Hang on, what did I do?
Well, you'll find out.
How did I get in trouble already? I haven't even said anything.
For gamers who run Linux, you can game more now.
Thanks, Steam.
Microsoft revises forced reboots in Windows 8.
I don't like it when the boys hassle you about it.
I was at GCAP, which is the Game Connect Asia Pacific conference.
I told you it was GC something.
It's the Punch and Lena show by the looks of the correspondence.
Sexting is, it's been around as long as mobile phones have had cameras on. You know, my child has racked up a $5,000 bill. Well, whose fault's that?
It's Telstra calling it 4G when it isn't.
Don't forget, they have Big Pond TV and Foxtel and all sorts of stuff. So
the latitude is basically how much colour information you store when you record the image.
What lengths would you go to watch free-to-air television?
Not me.
They've already got the database that had the encrypted credit card details in it.
Gaming frequently changes your brain.
I know. Look at Dr. Ron.
Yeah.
Entertaining, informative and independent.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the second last edition. Is this the penultimate edition,
it
Dr. Ron?
You've done extremely well.
All right, I got it.
It's taken you a year.
It's only the penultimate edition for the year.
And for 1 year only. For one edition only.
Oh, good. Otherwise, we wouldn't be back.
So it's next week, the ultimate.
Correct.
Oh, great. I've finally worked
it's
out.
It's got
it,
ladies and gentlemen.
Yay, where's Warlock when you want him? Call in, Warlock.
We had progress in the Andrew McComb English learning project.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it, Greg? Progress.
Yes.
Yeah, good.
We'll teach him to speak the language sooner or later.
Split infinitives next year. You watch.
Gosh, that sounds exciting. Speaking of splitting infinitives, Lena Van Deventer joins us on the panel.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Lena would never split an infinitive.
No.
Never.
Wouldn't you?
Maybe. If it looked at me funny, I might have no choice.
Oh.
Ooh.
All right. Moving onward.
Tech Talk Radio doesn't incite violence.
Or condone the splitting of infinitives.
No.
I'll boldly go where no man has gone before, if you're a Douglas Adams reader. Yes. Graham, don't.
I think that was Roddenberry, actually.
No. In Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, to boldly split infinitives that man has split before.
That was Adams, yes.
Yes. Sorry. We're cross purposes. Anyway,
you
welcome.
You can't split an infinitive in any other language other than English, I don't think.
Really?
Yeah, it's because with our infinitive parts of the verbs, we say to something, to split, to boldly go, to go, or whatever. But in Latin, I think it was considered bad practice to do that because...
Have you got a grammar geek alert to go beside your nerd alert on your...
No, I was interested in this. The reason I'm interested, because I was doing ABC Radio today, and we were doing technology, and after technology was an author who'd come on doing a book about how they'd bastardized English and how the English had transformed... And they were calling it Manglish, the Book of Manglish.
Manglish.
So I had my, I had to chip in and give my 2 cents worth about, the verbs of Googled and 10 years ago, what did tweet mean? Well, it meant a bird in a tree, didn't it? So, look what technology's done to English. Mm. What have the Romans ever done for us?
We now have Microsoft English.
But do we?
Well,
don't we?
It is interesting what technology's done for English. One of the things it's done is it's caused us to have a huge record of effectively spoken English written down. Because the way people use emails, and particularly the way they use online chat, is that they type what would otherwise be spoken English as opposed to written English.
Yeah, that's very true.
And it's a fascinating record. It's something that in past generations, the spoken form of the language wouldn't get written down nearly so in such abundance as it has been lately.
Yeah, English. Wouldn't want to be a kid these days. Really, would you? My poor little...
Oh, yes.
Emily, my
never a better time in the history of mankind to be a kid.
Yes.
Yep.
We'll get... you get taunted from afar. I have my six-year-old Emily.
Yeah, there's always disadvantages, but there's many more advantages, I think.
I was discussing the word poor with her the other night. There's a cat's paw, there's pouring the water, and there's poor as in not wealthy.
Yes.
And she glazed over after the first one. kids are great, aren't they? Anyway, on tonight's show, we have lots to talk about. NBN things. We caught up with Mr. Conroy during the course of Friday's launch out at Docklands in Melbourne. And
that was a big event.
It was. It was huge.
It was the opening
They had sausages and... onion and bread
and journos. And a massive building full of the National Broadband Network's control centre and equipment and showroom and education centre, the whole lot, and they had a bus there that's going around the country.
We're talk about that after the Coro segment, briefly.
All right, sorry, I'll stop talking about
it now. That's all right. We've got Mark Diggins in, long-time panellist from way, 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 way back. Then he left and he went overseas for a few years.
Yep, went and left us.
Then he's come back and he does cameo roles. And tonight's one of those nights where we're going to hear from Mark.
Yeah. Mark's an expert in radio communications and you know, mobile phones and that sort of area, isn't he?
He is. He is. He's doing things with green fibres, but you'll find out about that later. Anyway, also tonight, Robert Broomhead is in. He is part of the Wireless Institute of Australia. And there's been a bit of a resurgence in amateur radio, hasn't there, Graeme?
Has there?
Yes, there has.
I missed it.
Yeah, no, you haven't. You should get on board.
I should get in the middle of it.
Yeah, you should.
I used to have an amateur radio license.
Did you? What did you do with it?
I think I might have forgotten to pay it one year and never followed it up again.
Oh, that happens. I do that with insurance all the time. But that's another story.
That's those worse. Pesky things like heating and water.
Yeah, those sort of things. Yeah. So anyway, we're going to hear a little bit about where the hobby is going to. It's going from strength to strength.
Amateur radio is what people sometimes call ham radio.
That's the American name.
Yeah, but it's also the name that a lot of people who aren't familiar with the hobby know what it is. It's radio for enthusiasts, you know, electronics and radio enthusiasts.
It's more than radio. It's TV, it's data, you name it.
Does
anyway.
Ham stand for something?
No.
Oh.
It's just ham, like amateur. Like, fact, you know, you're a ham, you're an amateur.
I thought you'd have an interest in it because bacon-like substance.
Yeah, well, I got all excited about the possibility of bacon.
Well, bacon radio is an offshoot of amateur radio. It's a specialist field.
A niche.
Yeah, it is.
Have you got something for us for gaming tonight to squeeze in our packed show?
Last one
for the year? Excellent. You going to tease it?
No,
or not?
Okay. Not giving any spoilers.
No spoilers.
Which is a spoiler within itself.
All right, Dr. Ron. Coro, over to you.
There's plenty of correspondence. We'll have to power through it tonight. feedback@techtalkradio.com.au. And, of course, hello to Phoenix FM listeners in Bendigo on Wednesday night and Way FM listeners in Launceston.
Yes, Launceston.
You have to do the rest.
Not Launceston.
Come on.
They're the newest stations.
Oh, there's the newest ones, yeah.
And if you've just had...
Catherine.
If you've just got, 8 KTR, Catherine. Yeah, Cairns. We've got people everywhere. We've got Cairns.
Been with
Cairns
it
FM.
For day one.
We've got stations in New Zealand. Hello to all of our New Zealand brethren.
New
listening.
Zealand.
Yeah, across the pond.
Kia ora.
But if you've just actually got Tech Talk Radio on your community station, let us know and we'll say hello.
Yeah.
Phil, via direct email, says, following up from the Ka-ching application. Ka-ching. He sent us a link to an Engadget article. SIM-based NFC gains global support from 45 mobile carriers.
Ah, yes.
I saw this. This was quite interesting.
The start of the article says, you knew that NFC hardware could be embedded into SIM cards, right? Right. Well, regardless of whether you've been paying attention, the practice is about to become a whole lot more common, as 45 of the world's largest mobile operators have extended their support for the GSM Association's standard. This is exciting. This is good. It means we don't have to have dopey cases and proprietary... builds of handsets.
That's all right.
To accommodate NFC.
That's a good idea. Near field communication is the way to go.
It's going to give more power to the big telcos, and the biggest of the big telcos are going to have the more power because they've already got the most power.
True, but they'll be able to elbow in on the e-commerce and e-trading and mobile phone trading, won't they?
What's the bet that Apple come up with a way to make their phones incompatible with SIM cards that have got NFC chips built in?
I'm sure they will. Well, they'll offer people incentives to use theirs, maybe financial incentives or something to use their standard.
They won't be financial incentives. You'll be crippled if you don't incentives.
The nice way to phrase that question would have been when someone locks it, not when a specific company locks it. Just saying.
When the big fruit company.
Just saying.
With a silhouetted piece of fruit with a bite out of it does something.
There's only...
Oh, bite out of you in a minute. Be nice.
There's only one major player in the mobile phone market that wants to take over our entire lives and move it onto iTunes.
Hey, listen, you two can take it
the
car park later.
Listen to the fangirl down the end there. Unbelievable.
I'm in the middle here. I'm feeling a bit insecure now.
I know. Your face has gone as red as your T-shirt has. Just keep your head down there.
The T-shirt's pretty red, too.
Exactly. Just bear in mind, New Zealand banks are launching an NFC trial, too. So if you're listening in New Zealand...
using what technology?
Shiny
very
technology.
Good. Yeah, shiny. NAB subsidiary Bank of New Zealand has kicked off a near-field communications payment trial with partnership Vodafone NZ, Visa and terminal supplier Paymark. The trial would see approximately 40 people. That's half of New Zealand. No, sorry. 40 people given Samsung Galaxy 2S handsets to make the payments of under $80 New Zealand at two cafes in Auckland and Wellington. So they're just trialling it. I don't know what you do with your Galaxy, but maybe it's got one of those SIMs in it that you speak of. Micro SD card adapters, I believe. Mm. Don't know what that means, but nonetheless, maybe they've got a little SIM in one of those.
Maybe.
I'll have to find out more about it later. Giving them a handset and not just a SIM suggests that it's something in the handset. But yeah.
Well, it'd be good to have it in the SIM card. That's what would make sense to have it there, wouldn't it?
It would.
That's your identity. That's got your mobile phone number in it.
Sorry, I just looked that up whilst you were chatting there.
No, it's good.
Thought I saw something in the news.
Phil, thanks for sending that through. I'll pop the link in the show notes. Aussie Cozzy on the forum asks, "Hi, I'm considering building my own computer.
Ooh.
Just need some advice on what I should build, the 32-bit or the 64-bit. Any advice would be appreciated." Ah, yes, says Aussie Cozzy. "It will be a desktop home computer used for internet, surfing, email, iTunes, general multitasking. Thanks."
64.
Okay, you're going to build your own computer. Step one is that really, unless you're building using really ancient hardware, it's going to be a 64-bit machine. But 64-bit machines can run 32-bit software. So you really, as long as you're using modern parts and processor and so on, your machine will be a 64-bit machine.
What dictates whether it's going to be 32 or 64-bit, Graham? Is it the processor or the motherboard or both? Or
It's primarily the processor, but obviously the design of the motherboard and other things flows from that. But all the processors that are around these days are 64-bit compatible. But you can run 32-bit software on it as well. So really, these days, what dictates it in practice is which version of Windows you buy to go on it, or which version of Linux you download to install on it, or whatever. Andrew?
There was a little bit of a nerd alert there.
Yeah, I'm trying to give good advice here.
He's giving very good advice. Graham's giving very good advice. So I guess ask the computer store where you're buying your bits and pieces from. If you're going to buy a case and a motherboard and a processor, ask them if it's 64-bit hardware.
Yep, but it will be, because all current hardware is. So your decision really, there's no point in running 32-bit software, 32-bit version of your operating system, particularly if you're going to put a lot of memory in the machine. So if you're going to run more than about 3 gig of memory, and it's standard to put 4 gig or more in these days, you may as well go to 64-bit operating system these days. And in fact,
everything you want nearly runs on it anyway, doesn't it?
Most things do these days.
Drivers just install.
There was a time where there were problems and there was less support for peripherals and things in, less drivers and so on for the 64-bit version. Those days are gone. 64-bit operating systems are everywhere these days. And it allows you to have a lot of RAM. So on my Windows machine, I've got 8 gig of RAM. I can run the workstation version of VMware, and I can have virtual machines running. I've got plenty of memory. I'm not going to run out of memory no matter what I do. And, yeah, it's
all good.
It is. It's all good. So
64-bit, way to go.
Aussie, yeah. I hope that answers your question. Tristan via the Tech Talk Radio contact form says, "Hi, guys." Hi, Tristan. "I was listening to your discussion about the remote desktop access clients you use."
Hasn't this started a fracas in the email world?
It has. "I use LogMeIn and Tight VNC." That's one we didn't mention
last
week.
Wasn't that one,
Graham?
You mentioned a VNC.
Well, mine is one variant of VNC, and this is another variant. So, yep.
"I found that Tight VNC is so much faster than LogMeIn. I've never used TeamViewer, though. I only ever use LogMeIn if my router loses power and the IP address is changed. Then I can log in using LogMeIn to get the new IP address. I also use Android VNC Viewer on my phone to remotely access my computer from my phone. It's so handy when there is a problem."
Be all right if you had a tablet. It's a bit hard to do it on the small screen device, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, Tristan reckons it works.
It is hard, but you can do it. You can get yourself out of trouble. I regularly RDP into my home machine.
What does RDP stand for, Graham?
Remote Desktop Protocol. It's the remote viewing thing that's built into Windows these days.
Excellent. So it works.
Cheers, Tristan. Thanks, Tristan.
Thanks, Tristan.
Also on the subject of remote access, Bob says, "Hi, Tech Talk crew." Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
"Just finished listening to last week's show. Happened upon another remote desktop application that I hadn't heard of before."
Here they come.
"Chrome Remote Desktop."
Oh, really?
"This CNET link gives Graham's a reasonable outline of its use. Interesting to note it's a simple PC to Mac solution as well. anyhow, keep flying.
What do you mean by that? You can log into your Mac from a PC. Is that what they mean? Or a PC into a Mac into a PC?
You can Mac into a PC if you want to.
Wow, that's great.
VNC is inherently cross-platform as well. You know, X-Windows, Windows, and Mac. Yeah.
Yeah. Good for support, guys. Yeah. I know that if you're an avid PC user, you probably wouldn't know what to do on a Mac, and probably vice versa. Worlds apart.
Regards.
I mean, it'd be easier to learn from PC to Mac than the other way
around. Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah.
Regards, Bob. Thanks, Bob. Carl, via the contact form, says...
Oh, how many have you got?
Oh, there's all of them tonight. Well, I just had an interesting week, says Carl. An electrical storm here in Melbourne sent a power spike into our house.
Uh-oh.
Taking out the cable modem, the router, the Ethernet port on my Mac, and an Apple TV, amongst other things.
Oh, at least the fridge is okay.
It turns out that you can't get a replacement cable modem off the shelf. So we had to wait 5 days for it to turn up, and what a frustrating 5 days they were.
Oh.
We're not huge internet users, but once it's taken away, you realise how much we've all come to rely on it.
Mobile prepaid can really fill the gap in crisis times like this.
He even couldn't get last week's Tech Talk until a week after it aired.
Oh, dear.
What?
No. Oh, no, Carl. That's terrible.
Unheard of.
Goes to show how dependent we've really become on the net. Now, is Yak in our chat room tonight?
Yes, he is. He's up the top there.
I happen to know he had a similar problem about a week ago. Couldn't...
What his, a bit of lightning
Optus,
up his...
Well, his Optus cable modem died. Yeah. And, yeah, very reliant on Optus to send a new modem and for them to configure it. You can't just go and buy one and set it up yourself you can with an ADSL modem. Very frustrating.
Yep.
An anonymous contributor says via direct email to me, he says, please keep me anonymous. A short time ago, my employer was called by a customer in need of computer replacement. There were two catches to this otherwise basic upgrade. The first was the computer was a multi-processor server.
What?
And damn expensive. Think middle five figures. Ooh.
Ooh.
The second was that they needed it at a research station.
That's why it wants to be anonymous.
Yes, they needed it at a research station just inside the Arctic Circle.
Yikes.
Everything has to be airlifted.
Brr.
We got the new system, shipped it to Canada. The plane flew low over the drop sites, established radio contact, pushed it out the back of the plane, and watched in horror as the parachute failed to open.
Oh, no! Really?
Next time you talk about a bad computer crash, just remember this one. And last but not least, Julie says, hi, guys. I'm a regular listener. My tech knowledge has improved immensely thanks to all of the panel. Oh, it's good to hear. Julie?
I think she contributes regularly, too. I've seen her emails come in.
Just listening to Warlock a week or so ago, I think he should be more of a regular on the show.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
I find his knowledge and ability to explain tech stuff fantastic. Keep up the good work, Warlock.
Call in Warlock if you're listening, but be quick.
Hey, what about a Christmas party? Is there one this year? Julie, there will be a Christmas party Friday the 9th of December. So it's the Friday after our last show at the Elgin in Hawthorne. So I'm not sure if you're local or if you're interstate, but if you can get down to Melbourne, we'll all be there from about 6:30.
So we're not doing the show like we did last year, but it's just a get-together.
It's just a get-together to catch up and meet people and say hello. And
yeah, we couldn't talk last year. Well, we could, but we couldn't, if that makes sense.
We had a lot of fun, but it wasn't a relaxing environment for us, was it?
No. No, there need to be beers and yummy things and bacon and stuff.
Yay!
That's we can chat.
Monumental feedback, Andrew. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au.
Listening to Australia's most informative technology show,
Tech Talk Radio.
Now, the NBN rolled out into town. Sort of, it's now got a home base, and we were there. What did you think, Dr. Ron?
I was very impressed
by
the facility there, the amount of the planning that's gone into it, the hard work.
Yep.
It's obviously they're well set up there. And it looks like it's going to be very promising.
We saw the front rack. There's lots of racks. It goes way, way back.
Oh, there's a lot more there than we're actually able to see.
Yeah. But it's very nice. It's very well done.
There's a lot of people put a lot of hard work in there, and they're not doing it by halves anyway. It's a big commitment. They're doing it properly from what we can see.
Now, some of the pictures that we took whilst we were there, you can go and see right now at the techtalkradio.com.au website. Scroll down the bottom left-hand side. You'll see a picture of a big truck. Just click the truck and it'll take you through the page and you can see some of the pictures. Because you put a great little report together during the course of the week. Dr. Ron, we spoke to a few people while we were
there,
didn't we?
Thank you. We all did. Yeah, it was a good team effort. But we did get to speak to lots of people. And yeah, this is some of what we did.
The company responsible for the design, installation and operation of the national broadband network is NBN Co. The network is slowly but surely being rolled out in metropolitan and regional test areas all around Australia. On Friday morning last week, NBN Co. officially launched its Network Operations Centre, Network Test Facility and Mobile Education Vehicle. The Minister for Broadband, Communications and the Digital Economy, Senator the Honourable Stephen Conroy, spoke to Andrew McCollum about what the NBN means for Australians.
You can see here from these demonstrations that the transformation that will come to everybody's lives in so many ways that even now you still can't imagine. And you look at the basic equipment, this is about touching and feeling and seeing that the transformation is real, that the services that are going to come in health, in education, in aged care, in sustainable environmental policy, they're all going to be able to be starting to be delivered with the volume rollout over the next 10 years. So this is a very exciting day.
I looked online last night. We're number 51 in the world for internet speed. What do you think this is going to do?
Well, I mean, this is going to jump us into the top half a dozen, top five. We look around the world, we see that other countries are building these sorts of networks. And if we want the best for our kids, if we want the best available technology for our children in the future, then we have got to do this. This is not a question of, we can leave it off 5 or 10 years. We will fall behind the rest of the world further and further and further, and then have a massive catch-up to try and do. We've got to put the NBN in place so that Australia does not fall behind the rest of the world.
Mr. Stephen Christian is NBNCo's Head of Network Operations. Andrew asked Mr. Christian about the expected longevity of the NBN infrastructure.
Copper has been in the streets for 100 plus years. How long is this going to be in the streets for?
We're hoping every bit as long. This has got a lot longer life expectancy because there's no electronics, there's no power on it out in the field. So one of the issues with the copper cable is that it actually has power running down it, and that requires a lot more energy, and that gets deteriorated over time. This doesn't require power over it. In fact, it's passive, and as a result, it'll last a lot longer.
It's just glass, isn't it?
It is just glass, but it's a very expensive glass. But it's glass that's designed for all the tensile strength necessary to support, you know, the normal knocks and shakes you get, but it'll support a lot more services for a lot longer than the copper has. Copper served us well for a long time, but it is reaching the end of its life, and this is the next generation.
So when you lay these cables in the street, how much future-proofing do you do? Obviously, you're only using a couple of circuits or a couple of pairs now. Are you catering for the future?
We are. Just like when the copper cables were initially put out there were a lot of what's called spare pairs. We're embedding spare pairs in the fiber as you put it out there. The major expense is laying of the fiber. It's literally cheaper to lay more of it than it is to lay just a few fibers. So we're leaving enough fibers in to future-proof the network for changes that will happen in the metropolitan or the regional areas that we can't even conceive of right now.
In addition to the predictable media throng, students from Bacchus Marsh College also stopped by to check out the new facilities. Most students, who lived about 60 kilometres west of Melbourne, said they relied significantly on mobile data and were looking forward to the faster internet speeds the NBN would provide them.
What does the National Broadband Network mean to you as a student?
Faster internet.
Just speed, pretty much. Like, I hate when you're trying to get something done or you're in a hurry and you need to check the weather and it takes, like, 15 minutes to try and get into it.
Looking forward to faster access, though, on the NBN?
Yeah, I am. So you can do your work quicker, research, get some more videos quicker so you don't have to be waiting for the whole lesson just to watch them.
Can't wait for speed.
That'll be faster, that we can use it more, because ours is very slow and we have five people in our family and we always use the computer.
Yeah, so I can't wait for it. It'll be good.
What sort of services do you use on the internet at the moment?
Well, social networking, gaming through consoles and stuff, and internet services like YouTube and basically stuff like that.
What sort of games do you play?
I play some Call of Duty on the Xbox. It's pretty good.
Yeah, social networking, email, games as well, gaming consoles. Yeah, stuff like that.
Call of Duty?
Yeah, Call of Duty. PlayStation man myself, though.
What do you do on the internet at the moment?
YouTube, search videos, do some homework on it. Yeah, a bit of Facebook.
Oh, I go on YouTube, Facebook, and, like, Google lots of things.
As we all oohed and aahed at the flashing lights in the test facility and the big projector screens in the Network Operations Centre, Senator Conroy told us that the unveiling of these facilities marks a new phase in the delivery of the NBN.
The design and implementation of the NBN has had many milestones in a few short years, and today represents a new phase of education and community engagement. Now we are showing Australians just what they will be able to do with the high-speed broadband delivered to their premises.
NBNCo's Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Mike Quigley, explained that in addition to the Network Operations Centre, the NBN test facility was also now fully operational.
This is our national test facility here, and this pile of equipment, and it goes back quite a long way, is integral to what actually happens on the NBN. As well as these cables and satellites and fixed wireless antennas, which you see, the things you can see, there's all this type of gear that's sitting in exchanges around the country. There's about 1,000 fibre access nodes are going to be deployed right around the country in exchange buildings with this type of gear inside them.
But forget the political spin and the corporate rhetoric. One thing's for certain, this is a massive infrastructure project which has now achieved enormous momentum. Despite threats and dire warnings from the federal opposition, at least at the coalface, it looks like the NBN's here to stay, and it's going to provide a solid foundation for Australia's telecommunications infrastructure well into the 21st century.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
So there you go, the lowdown on the NBN. It's very exciting, isn't it? And of course, that's Warlock. If you're hearing noises in the background. Yes, I couldn't hear his audio before. We'll get back to you in a sec, Warlock. Anyway, we have a guest in the studio this evening. Oh, by the way, before we go to that, I don't think there's much more we needed to talk about the NBN. It's really exciting, isn't it? We've got little boxes coming out already to be plugged in. And it was the first tangible sort of thing, really, wasn't it? You could actually see from a consumer's point of view, yep, of actually seeing it actually working.
You could actually see and you could actually see and touch and feel the customer equipment, and it was the first time we've been able to do that. So you can see the sort of stuff that's going to go on the side of your house, what's going to go inside your house. It's good.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway,
it's real.
It's touchable. Happening. It's real. It's happening.
Yeah.
And it's the green fibre that goes in the street. If you see people laying green stuff in the street, you know that's NBN. If they're laying other things like blue stuff, chances are that's Telstra. Well,
I hope I see them very soon.
Be good, wouldn't it?
Yep.
There's not too many in Victoria, but if you're one of our more regional listeners, chances are you've got more chance of seeing it before we do.
Yep. Well, one of the things they mentioned was that there's going to be an announcement early next year. Did they say January or did they just say in the early part of next year about the 3-year plan for the batch of rollouts? So who's going to get it when?
Yeah, the rollout plan's actually on their website. I think you can go to... off the top of my head, is it nbn.com.au, I think, and you can see the schedule there of what suburbs are going to get it when,
okay,
for the next 12 months or so. And they're going
there was definitely talk of an announcement early next year, though.
Yeah, that's right. Mr. Conroy said that there was going to be an announcement for the next, when the next people were scheduled to get.
Yeah, the state connected. Minister, whose name escapes me, also mentioned it. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Is it Gordon Rich Phillips? Is that right?
Anyway, that's
got
good.
My political thinking cap on now. Can't quite remember.
Lots to look forward to, I think, with the NBN. It's going to
definitely
be good.
Yes.
Now,
and the big revolution. It's actually going to affect us with our Tech Talk Radio production, and of course, you know, anybody who runs an online business providing content is that at the moment with ADSL and all these things, the upload speed is very limited. We got fast downloads, but we don't necessarily have fast uploads. And getting on the NBN, we can have symmetrical connections, so we can have fast uploads as well.
Yeah.
So I'll be able to get the podcast online for people quicker than ever.
Fantastic. It supports Apple too, I believe.
nbnco.com.au is the website. Ignore the one that I said previously.
And you can check out our pics on our website. See what we went and did.
Yep, Andrew's done a good job there. He's got a good gallery there of
and it will grow. We've got video to put up there too of all the stuff that we did as well. Anyway, the National Broadband Network is a wonderful technology, but if you cast your mind back many, many moons before that, before we had internet, how long have we had internet for now these days? 20 years?
Oh, since the mid-90s.
Yeah, about that. All right. Before that, there wasn't much around. The way we used to communicate was via the telephone.
Pages.
We had, what was that, Mark? Bulletin boards. That's right.
Boards.
Yeah.
Yep.
We had all those sorts of great things where it sort of didn't really happen for us. But one thing that did happen for us was amateur radio. Amateur radio has been around for many, many years, and it has evolved like a lot of technologies has to take into consideration of today's new things. Now, there's lots of amateurs sitting in the room. In fact, I think everybody in this room has a radio license, nearly. And I know I've had my amateur radio license for, I sat down and worked it out the other day, 30 years.
Oh, now you're really showing your age.
I know. And you have too, Dr. Ron. Well, not
you must have been like born with it then.
Yes, that's very kind of you.
That's right.
Anyway.
You can get cash later.
Oh, okay, good. Shall do. There's been a bit of a resurgence of late into the hobby. Maybe the internet thing is sort of, everyone's been there and they've realised that let's go back to our roots, let's go back to the world of amateur radio. So none better to tell us about what's going on than Robert Broomhead, who's from the WIA. Hi, Robert. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, good evening. How are you?
Good, thanks. Now, this is encouraging news, isn't it? People are heading back towards the hobby.
Absolutely. It's, well, back in 2006, we introduced a new amateur radio license called the Foundation License, which is a really easy to get license. You simply do a one-day training course and you can get yourself into the hobby of amateur radio.
That's good. And you can be just interested in the hobby. You don't need any qualifications. You can drive an MP3 player or you know how to hook your stereo up. That's got to be a start, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Anybody with any level of interest in technology. In fact, you don't even require any detailed knowledge of technology at all. We'll teach you that in this one-day course.
Great. So there's hope for Lena.
That was harsh.
Oh,
she wasn't listening. I was just thinking she was listening.
I think she just cancelled out of our course in the end of the year. Yeah.
So it's designed to get people into the hobby, and the hobby has many aspects, doesn't it? From television, from one end of the scope, through to satellites, through to. Can you paraphrase it quickly? You probably can't. There's so much to talk about in the hobby, isn't it?
Yeah, it's communications by many and very different means. You've touched on a couple, satellite communications. There's shortwave radio, you know, long distance, you know, talking around the world on the old shortwave radio.
That's what everyone sort of remembers, isn't it? That romantic sideband sound of...
Goes back about 100 years here in Australia to when people were first experimenting with shortwave amateur radio.
And it was a big thing back there. You used to talk from one side of the world to the other. Didn't get any better than that, did it?
That's right. People used to think crazy things like play games of chess with each other across amateur radio and move the chess pieces across this, playing you know across the other side of the world.
I'm sure they still do, but maybe the chess pieces move because they connect on the internet and just chat online. But yeah, so there's all those sorts of good things. Talking on the other side of the world, satellite. What can people do on a satellite?
They can transmit data and voice via satellite.
Is that hard?
No. No, not really at all. The way that they've set up the satellites, they're all the time building new little satellites. And in fact, a lot of schools are creating, schools and universities are actually creating projects where the students and the university graduates actually build microsats or CubeSats that they send up into space. They launch them off Russian transport vehicles and things like that, launch them into space, and there they float around the Earth in orbit for goodness knows how many years.
Fantastic. So if you're looking for something to do over the summer holidays, now's the time to get your license and get out there and do it. So I'm envisaging young people and old people, or people of all ages
yep.
Sitting down and they've got their computer there, they're tracking a satellite, and they're trying to talk to someone through that satellite.
That's right.
What fun.
That's it.
And Grant in our chat room says, don't forget the Scouts. Scouts have created their own amateur radio network in Victoria.
That's right. Yeah, the Scouts are a big big player in amateur radio. Every year we have an event called JOTA, which is a Jamboree of the Air, and it's like a Scout Jamboree where we get together on amateur radio and also the internet, and all the Scout groups around the world get to talk to each other via ham radio and the internet.
That's great, isn't it?
But that's probably the first exposure that a lot of adults have to amateur radio, because they have their kids, their sons and also their daughters now in the scouting movement. They're probably exposed to amateur radio in the first instance through JOTA. I know that that's certainly very popular with the young kids, isn't it? Mm.
One of the other things that we do for young children is give them the opportunity to speak with the astronauts on the International Space Station. Part of NASA's publicity and media program is to make sure that all of the astronauts that go up onto the ISS, the International Space Station, have got amateur radio licenses, and us as radio amateurs and a group that I'm involved with regularly go around schools where we set up contacts between a group of school students and all the parents. They all come along to the school hall one particular night. It's a prearranged contact, and the students actually get to talk via amateur radio directly to the astronauts on the International Space Station. It's just an absolute magic experience, and something I'm sure that the kids and the parents will never forget.
I was about to say, who has more of a buzz, the kids or the parents? Oh, the parents would be pretty, because the kids take technology for granted these days, but still I'd see the parent, oh, my little so-and-so spoke to the space station, like, that'd be such a great talking point for the parents as too, as
it
well.
It is. And I was talking to one of the school principals for a school that we've done these ISS contacts for, and he said that to me that often when a student will leave a school, if it's a primary school, they'll leave at the end of year six, and there's often the conversation about what was memorable during your school, you know, your learning time at the school, at the school. And quite often it will be things like that contact that we had that night when we got to talk to the astronauts on the space station.
I must admit, I've had the pleasure, I think, of very briefly talking to Andy Thomas when he went over once upon a time, many moons back, in one of those big things that don't fly anymore. He's a South Australian boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Astronaut who...
And I still remember that, so I reckon you're spot on, Robert.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so there's obviously, speaking to space stations, there's satellites we've covered, there's television. We're talking about television
before.
That's
right. We've got our own digital amateur television transmitter on Mount Dandenong. So as radio amateurs, we can put together our own broadcast material and put it to air.
Now, how many of these are around Australia? We're speaking in Melbourne, but is there one in Sydney? Is there one in Adelaide?
I believe there's one in... I hope I don't get this wrong. I think there's one in the Ballarat area.
Okay. So there's a few out there anyway.
And there's one, certainly at least one in Tasmania, Sydney. So most of the major capital cities have at least got one, and there's possibly more in each state.
Now, a repeater does what it says. It takes you transmit to it and it rebroadcasts out. Normally that repeater's on a big high hill or something like that so everyone can see and hear. So everyone can see and hear what's going on TV in Melbourne, which is not from a commercial broadcaster.
That's right. So if you can get a set-top box that's got manual tuning, there is a link which I'll give to you. You can put it on your Tech Talk Radio website.
Yep. And it is, yes, in Ballarat. Someone on our chat said there's one up there.
And we'll put that on your and that'll be information on how to tune into the what we call the VK3 RTV amateur TV repeater on Mount Dandenong.
Okay. Now, you've got to bear in mind, too, that entertainment's not what it's all about, is it? It's about people sharing experiences, transmitting television and...
That's right.
It's all that. You're not going to see Seinfeld there.
No, but you might see some interesting footage and...
Of Jota, maybe.
Of Jota?
Yep.
Or maybe even of Dick Smith, for example.
Oh, really? Do tell.
Well, at the centenary celebration, which is 100 years of the Wireless Institute of Australia, we had a 100-year celebration because last year, in 2010, the Wireless Institute reached 100 years of operation in Australia.
That's an achievement, isn't it?
Now, actually, let me just explain. Wireless Institute of Australia, we're the group that represent the interests of the hobbyist here in Australia. So we liaise with the Australian Communication and Media Authority, etc. So for 100 years...
15,000 Australians are amateurs, aren't they?
15,000 Australians are amateurs. And
so you represent quite a few.
Absolutely. In 2010, we reached our anniversary, 100 years anniversary. And our patron, we're very fortunate to have Dick Smith, VK2DIK, who's a radio amateur, as the patron for our celebrations. And, we were very fortunate to actually have a personal visit to Dick's property at Gundaroo. So 200 of our members were able to participate in that. Dick gave a couple of interesting talks, and at some stage it's possible that you may see on ATV...
One of those talks.
Footage like one of those talks.
Yeah. So Dick Smith, obviously, is the namesake of the electronics shop, which I think Woolworths is currently owning and about to sell.
Yeah, Dick Smith hasn't actually owned it for many years.
But he started it all off. I remember some really good stories back there. Did he talk about his days back when he used to run the shop?
One of those talks, which we were able to film, was the life story of Dick Smith, how he started off in car radio, developed it into an electronics parts business, and... it was just history from there. It grew. The number of stores grew to the point where, it grew to the point, I guess, that Dick decided to...
call it a day.
Yeah,
huh?
He's going to quit while he was ahead.
Because he's into aviation too, big time. He used to fly and do all that sort of things. And I think we're probably quite aware of his antics in aviation recently. He's a bit of stands up for common sense in a lot of respects. Oh, well, that would have been... Quite and Dick was he's been a radio amateur ever since I can remember. I think he was one when I joined the hobby. So
yep, VK2DIK. And one of the things that he likes to do, you mentioned he's into aviation. One of the things he likes to do is to actually make contacts whilst he's in the air.
Very good. Oh, well, we'll keep a listen out for that. All right. What other great aspects of the hobby do we have? Obviously, it brings a lot of people together from all over the world, so...
Mark Diggins is in the chat room here. He's got
he's
a good
behind
one.
You too.
That's right.
He is. He's behind me as well. But in the chat room, he says balloon launches.
Oh, yeah, they
what,
were fun.
What are balloon launches, Robert?
Well, balloon launches are where we launch a weather balloon. So we get permission to do this, but we launch our weather balloon and we attach to the weather balloon a transmitter. Now, these transmitters that we attach to the weather balloon are generally built by hand by electronics enthusiasts who are radio amateurs, and we include such things as television cameras and data loggers and data recorders, so that when the balloon goes up, we're able to watch either captured still footage or video footage of the actual balloon itself as it goes up and then hovers across, and eventually the balloon will burst and the payload will be deposited somewhere.
What goes up must come down. But do you get the equipment back though? How do you find it?
Yeah, well, that's a that in itself is a is part of the experience. It's what we call a fox hunt or a hidden transmitter hunt, and that's where people on the ground with directional radio antennas, look a little bit like a TV antenna. You know how they're directional? You point the TV antenna in the direction of the signal that you want to receive.
Yep, sure.
So we've got people on the ground with those directional antennas, and they'll be working out which way the balloon's travelling, and they'll be travelling in their car to try and track and follow the balloon. And it becomes a bit of a competition to see who can find the payload.
And what's the success rate? Do you get them all back? Or?
Oh, occasionally there'll be one that may be deposited somewhere that is just inaccessible. But by and large, most of the times the payloads are recovered. And
I do remember doing one of those activities many, many years ago, probably with Mark, who's behind us here. We'll talk about it shortly. But I remember when these balloons get up to their high altitudes, they become the size of several houses.
Yep.
And quite visible from where you are on the ground, if you can spot it. And I do remember lying on a country road in the middle of a T intersection, just lying, having a coffee and looking up at one of these said balloons, which was just a white little dot up in the sky with a couple of other colleagues. And all of a sudden, it's popped.
That's
and
right.
The coffee went absolutely everywhere. We threw everything back into the car, and we took off as this thing came down sort of very close to the ocean, the Victorian Ocean. I think it was about 5K from the beach. Yep. So we were very lucky on that occasion. We did get it back.
A dark splat in our chat room says it's a bit like geocaching.
It is,
almost
isn't it?
Exactly like geocaching, but instead of knowing in advance or getting clues as to where the hidden payload is, you've got to find it by listening to the radio transmission.
And another thing that we do that's a little bit like geocaching, and Mark Diggins is sitting here behind me, it's an event that Mark was involved with as well, what we call an ARDF event, Amateur Radio Direction Finding event, where we, it's a cross between orienteering and hidden transmitter locating.
So if you're a techno person and you like running, this is for you, isn't it?
Like the great outdoors?
Yeah, like the great
outdoors. Like the great outdoors.
Sticks, scratches, mosquitoes, rivers, obstacles, all sorts of things.
Leeches, blackberries, creeks.
Yeah.
So, in a nutshell, we go and find a particular area, and in this year's event, a Region 3 event, so it was an international event. We had about almost 100 people coming from places such as China and Korea and Japan, Kazakhstan and the United States to Melbourne. We went to Malden, and there were two events.
That's up Ballarat way.
That's right, yep. Malden's up Ballarat way.
It's goldfields.
Yeah.
Great country for hiding
beautiful
transmitters.
Up there, you can imagine.
So we hid six transmitters. There were 2 days. We had two events on 2 days. We hid six transmitters on each day, and it was a competition to for each participant to put on his headphones, his directional radio finder, and to run like crazy and to find as many of those hidden transmitters as possible in the least amount of time.
So you get a map, if I remember correctly, which is traditionally covered in something you can write on with what do they call those marker things?
Oh, like a chinagraph pencil.
Yeah,
or something.
Overhead projectory type sort of things.
Yep.
Yeah, so you sit down there and they'd come on, the transmitter would come on every so often in a cycle, and you could, from where you were, you could say, well, that one's that way, that one's the over the other way, and then you draw it on the map, and you've got to find, I think there's five of them, isn't it?
Yeah, about five or six.
And you've got to do it in a certain time, and you get very fit and wet doing it, or scratch, or wherever you might be, whatever type of course these nice people lay out for you.
That's right. Well, there's a varying number. Depending upon your age and your category, there's a different number of transmitters that you're intended to find. But you're absolutely right. You're provided with a map, and using your directional receiver, you'll work out which direction you think each of those transmitters in. You'll plot those as lines on your map, and then you try and make the most you try and determine the most efficient route to actually visit all of those transmitter locations and be at the finish line as fast as you possibly can.
Yeah, there you go. Something for everybody in amateur radio, isn't there? From the good old days of just talking right through to being incredibly active and being part of it, I guess. So, all right, we're talking to Robert Broomhead, who's in representing the Wireless Institute of Australia this evening. So, emergency comms.
Yes.
We have fires all over Australia and stuff like that, and we have, incidents, I guess, in general. The reason why I said fires is because we're coming up to, you know, the summer season here in Australia. And obviously we have issues where traditional communications doesn't cut it, mobile phones and the likes. How does amateur radio play a part in this sort of thing, Rob?
Amateur radio can be a real benefit in times of bushfires and things like that. It provides people who are radio amateurs can communicate with each other, and it provides their own separate form of communications outside of any mobile phone networks. For example, there were, at the time of the last bushfires, there were people who were stranded in their homes without access to the internet or phones. The mobile phone towers had been burnt out, so they've lost their internet access, so they've lost their phone lines. Some of those people were radio amateurs, so that they were able to keep in contact with friends and colleagues and provide health and safety reports of what was happening in their local area. But one of the other areas where radio amateurs can provide a real benefit, I guess, as people who have a passion and a hobby for communications, we became well-skilled in communicating, using the microphone, communicating via two-way radio with each other. So when it comes time to, when there are serious bushfires, for example, and resources are running low, the CFA, for example, have got their own skilled radio operators and people who are trained in using the two-way radios. But when disaster strikes and manpower is really required in the field, one of the things that we can do as radio amateurs is provide stand-in operators to operate the two-way radios and the communications facilities on behalf of the CFA radio operators. And the advantage of that and has really been recognised, and it's one area that the Wireless Institute has actually been... we've now got a program which is run by by our RTO organisation, and that is actually training people up to a certification standard in two-way communications so that we can be a recognised body and an available team to assist the emergency service organisations when extra radio operators are required.
The good thing with amateur radio, Robert, that people, you know, mightn't fully understand is that it's independent of existing mobile phone infrastructure, internet infrastructure.
Even communication systems like we've just spoken of, police, ambulance,
fire. That's right,
fire.
Yep. Any other mobile phone network or radio telephone network, it's completely standalone and it's completely independent. So that's an absolute bonus, yeah. Yep. There's something that that probably is an obstacle for people like getting into amateur radio, and it's something which, you know, which a lot of people say, look, amateur radio sounds very interesting and it'd be great to be involved in balloon launches and direction finding and that sort of stuff, but it's cost prohibitive. These sorts of radios cost tens of thousands of dollars and the licensing must be horrendously expensive and can't possibly afford it. But where do we sit at the moment, like, you know, 11 years into the 21st century, you know, in terms of what these things cost?
The radios themselves?
Yeah, and the outlay for amateur radio as a hobby.
Look, it's compared to a lot of other hobbies, it's actually very, very affordable. And I'm saying that not only as an enthusiast myself, but realistically, it is quite affordable. The courses themselves that are run by the radio clubs around Australia, and I say clubs because there's hundreds of radio clubs around Australia running courses, are all done absolutely at minimal cost. Then there's the assessment, which is the bit you need to get your radio license.
So you do an exam or some sort of assessment?
Yep, that's right. And then you get your radio license. And the radio license itself isn't expensive. It's what, less than $100 a year. I think it's around, around $60 or $80 or something like that a year. And that's the radio license that you need to, the money that you need to pay each year, Graham, to keep your amateur radio license.
Yeah.
That was a backhanded one, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
I just did one the other day, $66 for a
there you
license.
Go.
I'll give Graham the forms so that he can get his license.
Oh, that's good, Hugh. That's good. Right. I would appreciate some assistance from the WIA doing that.
We're talking to Robert Broomhead from representing the WIA this evening about the hobby of amateur radio.
The Wireless Institute of Australia.
That's right. It's a good hobby. It's one of those things you can put it down for a few years and come back to it, and it can grow and change as you do too. You touched briefly on the price of equipment, getting in there, Dr. Ron, which is obviously, as Robert was alluding to, is quite affordable these days.
It did used to be very expensive. I can remember 10, 15 years ago, you did used to spend thousands of dollars on radio equipment, but having a look at the prices this day and age...
Before that, people used to just buy the valves from the local shop and build their own equipment.
Well, that's the other
what
thing
happened
that
to
puts,
those days?
Yeah, the other thing that puts people off valves is they on. Say, I'd like to get into it, I'd like to talk to people on the radio, but I don't know where to start. I can't build this
what
stuff myself. I don't have
radio
the knowledge.
Radio clubs.
Yeah, radio
Plenty
clubs.
Of them?
Plenty of radio. Well, there's about over 200 radio clubs in Australia.
So it's got to be one near you.
There are many, many near you, I think. There's in Melbourne. In Melbourne, there would be, in Victoria, there would be probably about 20 radio clubs. In the Melbourne metropolitan area, you've got a choice. There's probably a choice of about 10 or 12. And that takes you down the peninsula and up to the western suburbs, northern suburbs and places like that.
So where can listeners find out about their local radio club, and can they just rock up?
They can indeed. All radio clubs, well, I don't know of any radio club that doesn't have an open arms visitors policy where we just love to have people come along and join in and mingle with us for a night and see what we do. The website of the Wireless Institute of Australia, that's website address is www.wia.org.au, has a special section there on radio clubs, easy to find, with a map, the Google map that you can then zoom in and find your radio club in your local area. Now, my radio club is the Eastern and Mountain District Radio Club. We're in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne, meet in the Whitehorse area and Burwood area. And if anyone's interested, we're actually going to be running a amateur radio foundation license course. That's the one that we do. It's a single-day course.
So this is the easy one, which will get your foot in the door, get your license in next to no time.
One of the things that we have done for many years is to run a course during the Christmas New Year period. We've actually found it's a lot of people have got time off. They've got a little bit of time to spare, and it's a great opportunity to jump in and do the 1 day training course and be able to sit for your assessment and get your amateur radio license.
And Robert, what level of knowledge do I need before I attend a course like that?
You don't need any particular level of knowledge, but an enthusiasm to...
Enthusiasm, right. That's what it's all about, isn't it?
Enthusiasm, yeah.
So a general interest and a willingness to learn.
That's right.
Is probably
there. Look, there are people in our radio club who have become very enthusiastic, and their wives and partners have also become interested, and a lot of those wives and partners have done the foundation course and are now joining their... hubbies in the hobby of amateur radio.
That's great. All right, so if we've whetted your interest this evening, first port of call is the website, would it be, Robert? And
then yes.
What would the next, to walk us through, what should we do?
Okay, so if you're interested in, if you're from around Australia, you'd like to find your local radio club, it's the website of the WIA, www.wia.org.au. Go to the club section, find a radio club in your local area. And if you're in Melbourne and you're in the eastern suburbs, or you don't mind travelling to the eastern suburbs, then on Tuesday, the 27th of December, that's right in between Christmas and New Year, we're running a radio club down at our radio club, we're running a foundation course, and you can get the details of that off our club website, which is www.emdrc. It's emdrc.com.au.
Now, other radio clubs around Australia would be doing the same thing too, so just find links off the local division, would
yes,
that be?
For yeah, find links off the WIA website to a radio club in your area, and you'll find that pretty much all radio clubs will have a section on their website detailing up-and-coming training courses.
I'm just looking at the WIA website now. It's really cool. I got a map with little radio towers where the radio clubs all are.
Oh, how cute.
So you can very easily find the right one and just click on the tower, and it takes you to gives you the information about the club.
And if you just click on that link there, Graham, it will then take you to a full page.
And that one I've chosen is the Sherbrooke Community Radio Club.
There we go. And there's some information there
on
what they're doing and when they're doing it.
Well, that's fantastic. So that's your summer project, everybody.
What's the duration of that foundation course, Robert, like in terms of time commitment?
Just one day.
Oh, that's all right. So it's not like a six-week course or anything
that. No. There are more advanced courses you can do if you want to do the more advanced licenses, but a single one-day training course, we start 9 in the morning, we finish by 4 or 5 in the afternoon. That's the training day, and then it's simply to sit the test, and we usually do the test the following day or a couple of days later.
So it's fresh.
That's fresh.
That's very manageable, isn't it?
Yep,
it's good.
And then you're on the radio.
Yeah.
Then who knows what it'll lead to? You'll end up like a doghouse, like I've got at my house. And ostracised from the house.
A lot of amateurs tend to specialise in, they'll go in and they'll get their licence to start off with, and they'll have a particular interest in one field. So they might have a particular interest in amateur television or particular interest in radio direction finding or something like that. And you tend to go down your own path once you've got started.
Well, once you're in, it's great. That's the joy of it, isn't it?
And of course, radio amateurs are just like other hobbyists and other enthusiasts. If you go in and you show even the slightest interest in their hobby, in their field that they're passionate about, they'll be very welcoming of and very they'll have a very strong tendency to include and to explain what they're doing and to explain how things work. So it tends to be quite inclusive that way.
That's how the hobby works, isn't it?
You should get your license, Graham.
I should. Yeah, I did once.
Yeah,
I'll give you the paperwork.
Yeah, good, excellent. Robert, thank you so much for coming in and joining us tonight. I think we've dotted the I's and crossed the T's and everything. I think it's a great summer project for anyone who's got a day to speak. And if you're in Melbourne, that's great. If not, check out your local radio club on the WIA site.
That's right.
And who knows? You'd be up on the radio having fun with us in the not-too-distant future.
That's right. Thanks for having me on the show.
Pleasure, thank you. Now, we're going to have a quick listen from Adam Turner's View from the Couch, and Mark Diggins is going to join us after this.
Adam Turner's View from the Couch.
After all these years, why is password still a popular password? I've lost track of the number of times I've read about the importance of strong passwords, but it seems the message still isn't getting through to many people. According to a recent analysis of millions of stolen passwords, the most popular passwords are still password, 123456, and the surprising 123456789. Surely no one seriously believes that these are sensible passwords. I'm guessing such people are just lazy or they don't believe they've got anything worth stealing. The problem is that their laziness is also putting other people at risk. Using weak passwords for email and social media means you're likely to get hacked by scammers who will then try to scam your friends by pretending to be you. Scams such as, "I'm stuck overseas, please send cash," might seem obvious, yet people still fall for them because the message appears to come from someone they trust. Of course, some people are also silly enough to use weak passwords for more sensitive services. To make matters worse, they use the same weak password for everything. The PlayStation Network hack is a classic example of why this is a really bad idea, as you can be sure that hackers will use the same email password combinations to try to access other online services such as email, Facebook, and online shopping. Don't think that this is a one-off. Steam was hacked the other day as well. Anyone who's got your login and password could potentially be hacked, so you need to make sure that if someone hacks that, you're not handing them the keys to your entire digital kingdom. You might think you've got nothing to hide, but sifting through your inbox, looking at even basic things such as emailed receipts, lets scammers build up a detailed profile of you, which can be used for identity theft.
I've spoken about building strong passwords before, but in a nutshell, I'd say they need to be at least 8 characters long and avoid dictionary words. They should contain a mix of upper and lowercase letters along with a few numbers and symbols. The best passwords look like gibberish, but are easy to remember. One handy trick is to use the first letter of each word in a phrase or a rhyme. For example, the first two lines of Humpty Dumpty becomes HDSOAWHDHAGF. Now, that looks like gibberish, but it's not hard to remember if you know that it's part of that phrase. Make some of those letters uppercase, some lowercase, drop in a few symbols and numbers, and you've got the foundations of a really secure password. If you're listening to this, then I'm probably preaching to the converted, but don't assume that all your family and friends are as tech-savvy as you. Encourage them to do a quick password audit and think about whether their passwords are strong enough and varied enough. Choosing strong passwords isn't that hard. Surely it's less of a hassle than dealing with someone stealing your digital identity.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Oh, Adam, I couldn't agree more. I don't know how many times I've heard people say, oh, it doesn't matter that I use my given name as my password because I haven't got anything worth stealing anyway.
Just put in password. That's and my password.
That's the number one. I had this same discussion. This is what I was talking about on ABC Radio today, too. It was password day or something. Anyway, it was all good.
But it's people like that that are responsible, directly responsible for the spam and the malware and all the things that infect our computers and make our life online a misery.
And they're opening themselves up to being...
If your password is password or it's something, it's 1234 or it's something really simple like that, then it's your fault that the internet is a miserable place to live in.
Don't you get password fatigue? Like, you know, you've got so many different things that have got a password and you've got to change it every 2 months or something like that, that it just gets beyond what you can remember.
There's ways to manage that. There's ways to create passwords that you can remember. And there's, although it's bad practice to share passwords between multiple systems, you can, to some degree, you can use the same password on multiple systems for less secure things.
Yeah, but you
just have to be aware that if one gets hacked, that you need to go and change them all.
Yeah, but if I've got 12 though, or 20, you know, between work and at home, and they all change at different rates, and I can think up a password once or twice, but I can't keep track of which ones have changed and which ones haven't. And if I store them on a text file, then that's just the easiest way to get hold of all of them. Then
until your computer gets nicked. But yes, yeah. So.
That was the disembodied voice of Mark Dickens, who's joining us on the panel. Welcome back.
Yes.
Thanks.
And also one of those people that likes involved in radio transmitters as well. We're all amateurs in here, which is very, very, yes.
Had a fun time for a week in Malden with Robert and a whole lot of international visitors.
Oh, yeah. This is the hide and seek, the ARDF, the direction finding stuff, yeah.
I was the transmitter referee, so making sure they didn't fall in a heap and batteries didn't go flat and they got tripped over once and we had to turn on new ones and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, really?
So a bit of fun.
Yeah. And did you have any incidents up there in respect to everyone managed to not fall over in the goldfields of Victoria and not hurt themselves?
No, someone tripped over one of the transmitters and broke the cable off the battery the backup's already running, so we just have to turn on the radio part of it. So
now, some of these guys take this very seriously, don't they? They come from all over the world, and they certainly like to play hard.
Yes, they do. Fortunately, it's more friendly in this Region 3 competition that Robert was talking about, but when you get to the World Championships, no such thing. It's all play hard there, you know.
Yeah, now I know, I think we all know a chap by the name of Bruce Patterson who goes and does it, and Brian Ackley too. Yep. They're very keen and enthusiastic. In fact, I think Brian, who has been on Tech Talk Radio talking about batteries probably about 4 or 5 or 6 years ago.
Did a great story on that.
It was very good, but he's very passionate about that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, his sniffer is his radio receiving box.
Sniffs.
Is probably the most used and respected device for amateur radio direction finding. And even it was on Fox News in America recently, Fresno News in California. His box was on that just last week.
Oh, very good.
There you go.
So if you want to get into that sort of thing, you've got to meet up with Brian. And
if you want to train up,
all that sort of stuff.
World Championships in Serbia next year.
Serbia.
Yeah.
Are you going?
Keep your head down.
No, I was asked to be a referee there, and I just really kind of justify spending a few thousand dollars to get across to be a volunteer. Yeah.
Oh dear. So what else has been happening? Mark, you've been on the show a couple of times this year since you've returned from the United States, where you've been living for a couple of years.
Yeah. I've been very busy with work. We're doing the 4% of the NBN that's the wireless part.
Okay, so you connect up the people that can't have the fibre or the satellite. You're that little bit.
The little bit in between.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's it about...
Now, this is not a mobile service. People seem to think that it's like mobile phone, but it's not. It's point-to-point, isn't it?
That's point-to-point. It's going to be a fixed sort of device with an antenna pointing at the tower, like off a hockey stick, which is like
where your TV antenna would
be on. So it's going to be similar to that, and it's going to be pointing directly at the tower. And it's definitely fixed. You can't even move to a different cell. It'll stop working.
Oh, okay. So it's sort of like locked to that very specific latitude and longitude.
Purposely.
So, and obviously, a little man's going to come out in his truck and put it in for you, I take it?
Yeah, he's going to come out and do some tests and trek around different parts of your house and make sure no trees or, not too many obstacles are in the way. And once he's worked out the best location, he's going to mount it there. And then it comes down, it's power over Ethernet. So up the top, there's going to be a box that's got the radio transceiver. And then it's an Ethernet cable with power running over it down to a bottom box, which will then have some ports out of it, which will, might have your broadband on one port and your voice over IP phone on another port. And the third port might be your fax or something like
that. Yeah, we've got pictures of that on our website now after Friday.
Yep.
They're a good thing. You go and check out what they look like. A lot of people out in the sticks would be going, well, when do I get it? How do I get it? I guess that's up to the rollout plan, which is obviously in place, which NBN Co. is doing.
And that website that Ron gave earlier gives some of those details and gives some of the the wireless footprint. So for the first release areas of Ballarat, Tamworth, Toowoomba, Darwin and Geraldton, and they've already got three sites on air as a trial in Armidale, New South Wales.
The website's nbnco.com.au.
Yep.
Now, does the wireless portion of the National Broadband Network have anything to do with mobile phones, or does it just share a tower which there's something mobile phone-ish on? How does it work?
Yeah, so they both are going to use an LTE technology, but what's very different is there's no mobility function in the wireless. Because we talked about this fixed service, we've taken out, or we don't need to use any of the overheads that require the mobility to transfer, hand off between one cell and another.
It's all gone. We don't need it.
Yep, that's right.
So it's not cellular in the sense that a mobile phone network is.
Yeah, that's right. And for like paging areas, we don't need to page a huge area because we already know where the terminal is. So we can keep those messages down low, which gives more throughput for the real data.
That makes sense. Makes a lot of sense.
Have you done any speed tests?
Yeah, Grant's asking the all-important question in the chat room there. Speeds? Question mark.
Oh, yeah.
I only can stick to the official line of 12/1, so okay. 12 downlink.
So you're going
to
get what they say the minimum spec is.
Yeah, so it can go higher than that. That's the guaranteed. It can go lower than that too. Now, what I'm trying to say is that if it's an unloaded cell, you're guaranteed to get 12/1. It could improve in
the
future.
Unloaded being that you're not sharing that same...
Yeah.
So with other people and
that's
block.
Right. So you're going to get guaranteed to that if it's an unloaded cell.
So chances are, if you're in the farmhouse in a big block of land, you're going to be the only person on the cell. Would that be fair enough to sort of guess, or would it be like how much space would be in a cell? A couple of square kilometres, or
and it's really hard to say. Some of them we're designing that go many kilometres, maybe up to 10.
Okay.
14 kilometres, and so others are a really short distance. They're really just covering just a town of a few hundred people.
Okay, so you could have a couple, maybe one, up to several hundred people in one particular.
That's pretty fair to say. And if you're right next to the tower, you could get higher speeds, but I'm not sure if that's going to be limited back at the core end so that everyone gets the same and they're not, you're not getting more than what someone else can get. So that's all to be worked out by NBN Co.
But people say they're worried about the wireless speeds, Mark, but to be honest, I'd be happy with that. I mean, it's like 12 megabits per second. That's
absolute nonsense. That's ADSL speeds. That's no advantage on what
we're... It's not Graham. It's ADSL
that I can get at home.
That's right. It's ADSL speeds in a laboratory or in Graham Callaghan world. It's not ADSL speeds in real world.
Graham lives very close to telephone exchange.
Yeah, 45 centimetres from the telephone exchange. Yeah. But I actually get...
But people on the fibre network are going to get much higher speeds than that, and they're going to get upload speeds, which this wireless thing isn't going to give them.
Yeah, I'm going to go for the 100 down, 40 up.
It's the upload ripper. Yeah, it's the upload speed that is going to be that the people on the wireless NBN are not going to get the upload speed advantage that the people on the fibre are going to get.
Yeah, that's true.
And NBN Co are very conscious of that, and they're thinking about e-health and video chatting, you know, with, as you've seen probably on the news before, where, you know, you've got a doctor in one area and a patient in another, and they're using the video conferencing.
And if you can't get high-definition video from the patient to the doctor, then the thing doesn't achieve that aim.
That's right. So they're very conscious of making sure the uplink is there and is strong, and it's a very different ratio compared to, say, an internet service provider. You know, so it's very much uplink limited, and there's a lot of uplink in there compared to if you were buying a wireless device from Telstra, where, you know, the service is more downlink and people streaming.
But you were saying there's a 1 megabit uplink.
I'm just telling you what's on the website.
Okay.
Let's leave it at that.
All right.
That's the official word.
I already get better than 1 megabit uplink on my 3G Telstra modem.
Well, you might do that, but some people out in the bush probably don't even have access to that.
I wouldn't be getting that at home on my ADSL 2+.
I don't get that at home either, but I do on my next year, like he's making a valid point.
Yeah, the upload.
But that's the mobile network. We're not talking about the mobile network.
But my point is that it's not even as good as a 3G mobile network.
Yeah, but if you're living in the country, you can't get that. And some people can't even get, you know, mobile phone service. So
if you don't have anything, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. Right.
It's a wireless service for 4%, so let's not confuse it with the 93% who are getting fibre.
Right. Yeah.
Now, the other thing about the wireless server, do you get the four ports like you do on the fibre service where, you know, you, the little cable comes down from the antenna on the side of the farmhouse or into the remote location, you plug it into this white little box, or it could be black, there's a couple out there on the market, and then you just choose which port, or you ring up a reseller such as Telstra or Optus or AAPT or IONET or any one of those resellers, and then they can connect into that port via the wireless network. Is that the same way it works?
Yep, exactly how it works. And you'll be told which port will give you broadband or which one you've signed on to. So if you've signed up for broadband, you'll get maybe that on port one, and you'll be told that that's on port one.
Yep.
And your voice over IP service might be on port three or something like that if you sign on for that later on.
Yep. So it applies to the city as it does to the regional. Any customer who is lucky enough to be connected via that NBN network, the same rules apply right across Australia.
Yeah, that's right. It's just a different way of delivering it, and each one has its own
idiosyncrasies, I guess.
Yeah, well, the technology, the different limitations. So with satellite, you know, you can get it anywhere pretty much, but, you know, you're going to have higher latency working off a satellite. So you've got to know where it's sort of going to fit in. And the wireless sort of sits around the edges of the fibre area, and the satellites for the more remote areas.
Is there any algorithm involved in determining what becomes a fibre area as opposed to a wireless area as opposed to a satellite area, or is it just have a look around and use common sense type sort of thing?
Look, I don't know the full answer because I've asked the same question many a time and I can't get the answer. And and maybe some of it's proprietary, or, you know, some of it's hidden behind and they won't tell us. But what comes into is the density of the housing. So if you've like your standard suburban block, that comes into it. And then how
close... Like a greenfield estate, because they're all being cabled up with fibre only, aren't they?
Yep. So if you just even the non-greenfield ones, the current ones, you know, it could be a town with 100 people and it's very close quarter-acre blocks or something, but that town might be 700 kilometres away from the next spot that the NBN are going to put their fibre. So then it's actually too far away to cable up in that respect.
The journos at the NBN Cooperation Centre launch last week gave Mr Conroy a fair bit of put him under a fair bit of pressure about how, you know, this decision is made.
They did, didn't they?
Yeah, and he said, oh, it's a very complex algorithm, and that's all I'm saying.
Yes.
It involves population density, it involves this, and it involves that, and it involves a random number generator, and whose electorates are nearby, and that's all I'm saying.
He did say that there was no political ramifications there at all, was it? It was all done purely by science.
It was quite funny, actually. He started out by saying, I'll let you in on a little secret, especially for this this media press conference here. The inside tip is that there'll be fibre going past some very, very safe Labor seats. There'll also be fibre going past some very, very safe Liberal seats. Also some very, very safe Green seats. A National seat. He said, it's everywhere. So just move on. Next question.
Or just don't say it's everywhere you need it.
Don't say it.
That's right.
Yes, that's been tried and failed, hasn't it? Yes. Anyway. All right. So that's the lowdown on the NBN, I guess. We've spoken quite a bit about it tonight. It's exciting times. And I guess from an observation, an outsider looking in, even if we have a change of government, it's going to be very hard to pull out or undo what's been done at the moment. Yeah, in fact, it'll be so hard wouldn't be cost effective, I wouldn't have thought.
NBN got a big juggling act on there because they've got the wireless part, they've got the fibre part, and the fibre part's changing depending on the cost and how far it is to roll it out. So we talked about that. Wireless sort of sits in the middle. With the satellite, though, you might have so much capacity, and if you're in northwestern Western Australia, you know, there's not many people out there, so your spot beam for your satellite is not really loaded. But if you're around the outskirts of the fibre areas around Melbourne and Sydney, there's still a lot of people there. So the very loaded areas for satellites, so that's why they need a lot of wireless in those. So that's for NBN Co. They've got this juggling act between not overloading a satellite and, you know, how much it costs to deploy fibre in those areas, and when where wireless sits in is in the middle, and it's like, well, you have to put it in here because it, you know, cost-wise, we've got to meet this many customers, and satellite, we can't, you know, we just don't have enough bandwidth up there for to cover these areas. So,
yep. No, it's a big juggling act, isn't it?
That's why there's a big algorithm that goes with it.
Look, I think it's going to be exciting. When do you reckon, they're saying 9.5 years to do Australia. Is that conservative, do you reckon? You reckon we'll get most people done by then, or?
Well, I don't really have much of a visibility on the fibre side, but the wireless part is really a 3 year program.
Wow, so that'll be done and dusted by the time a lot of people get fibre, some 6 years down
there'll
the track.
People getting wireless before fibre's into their adjacent major town sort of thing.
We had a chat to Steve Christian, who's the head of network operations of NBN Co. That was the American voice you heard probably earlier on in Dr. Ron's piece.
He was telling you all about the fibre, the green fibre.
Yeah, the green fibre that's being laid in the streets. And the other interesting thing too is that he was saying that the expense of laying the fibre is just that. Putting extra capacity in is not an expensive thing. So there's they're laying a lot of dark fibre. That's fibre that's not turned on at the moment to future-proof Australia's ongoing requirements for bandwidth down the track. Obviously, the faster you go, the more bandwidth is needed. So if we get to a point where we lift the stakes a bit more, they just turn on a few more fibres or change the boxes at either end of each cable, don't they?
Yeah, and if you think about it, you know, rolling out a cable that's got 12 fibres in it compared to rolling out a cable that's got 144 fibres in it, you know, there's a lot of manpower that's the same just for both. Doesn't matter what size the cable is. So if you think of it that way, you always roll out more capacity because
then you actually need.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the fibre itself is actually fairly cheap. It's the rolling out of it that's the expensive.
It's very small too, because we saw the fly-in cable at the NBN launch. And you know how you get the copper, that big heavy copper cable that comes in off your pole into your house? Mm-hmm. This thing was like so much thinner than that. It was really fine. But instead of having copper in it, it had glass in it. So, and then that one fibre just terminates into that little box.
Yep.
And away you go.
Yep.
Oh, look. All
exciting times, Mark.
It is.
Yeah, it's been very good.
So. Now, you were mentioning before, we were talking about, you know, satellites and things like that. Let's go a bit further. The sun. You've been playing solar stuff too.
Oh, not exactly solar stuff, but similar to that. I've been at the RACV Energy Breakthrough, which is for other states, is like the NRMA.
It's a motor club.
Motor club. So they run an event every year for secondary and primary schools in Maryborough, Victoria. There's about 10,000 people go there, and like the primary schools have human power vehicles, so it's like a lie down bike with a big wind resistance, all enclosed and that sort of thing.
Yeah, those things you see on the BP Challenges and stuff, those
like, it's
that
like
pop
that
up,
without the solar panel. Now there's parts that are involved with charging up batteries for the secondary schools, and they use hybrid vehicles where they actually do some riding but at the same time have a little motor in the back, and some of them run on batteries, and you know, there's a lots of different classes, so it's a really good event, and I've just been to see that for the last few days. Just got back on Sunday. Very interesting event, so if you want to look it up on the website, it's very interesting with the photos there, what the vehicles look like and what the kids are up to.
What's the website, mate? Do you know? Or
RACV Energy Breakthrough. If you do a Google search on that, I think you'll find it.
RACV Energy Breakthrough.
I think it's really good that the kids get involved in some things too.
It's racvenergybreakthrough.net.
There you go.
You've done well.
Yep.
So what did that involve? Was that a couple of days away or something like that?
Yeah, it was 3 days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And I think depending on whether you're in secondary school or primary school or which class you're in, you sort of race at different times. But half of it's to do with the race and the other half's to do with your presentation and your scrutineering. So you have to actually give talk on, you know, mental health and your well-being and why you're reading this and the safety features you put into the car and how you made it more efficient and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
The kids must love this. Yeah. This is great stuff, isn't it?
It's great. Great pictures on there, and that's the thing. So that was really good. And recently,
that was in
Maryborough. Yep. Just one thing on to mention on technical side of things. I don't know if any of you guys have done it before, but I recently used one of those cameras with a GPS inbuilt.
Oh, yes. GPS receiver in the camera.
Still one or a motion one?
No, still camera.
Oh, yeah.
But for work, and then able to take the pictures and then put them into Google Earth, and that's just fantastic.
So it writes your latitude and longitude into the image when you take
into the EXIF data.
That's it. Right.
And then I just used Picasa to create a Google Earth file and then put them into Google Earth. And like I was out back, like, you know, northwest and Western Australia, so right out back. And, you know, just to be able to take a photo and put Plockett right on the map and say that's where I took that photo.
That's amazing.
Because everything else is just scrub, if you like.
What type of camera was that that you were using?
It was a Sony. It was not too expensive. Well, I think Sony Ericsson have some partnership, so it was a bit cheaper, but it was like less than $300.
Yeah.
And it's a recent model, and it was really good. So I'm thinking about next time I'm getting a camera, I'm getting one with a GPS inbuilt.
Yeah, there's some very good little point-and-click cameras around these days that have got that feature built in, and it is wonderful for that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think it's a 16-megapixel with 16-times zoom, so it's pretty good.
But ah,
it's
that's not a good.
Digital SLR. It's not one of those,
no.
It's still a point-and-shoot, but just got a GPS inbuilt.
But the important thing is to have... That's one of the other features I always look for, even on a cheap sort of... what we used to call an Instamatic camera. I don't know what they call them nowadays. Normal person camera.
Yep.
Well, happy snappers.
The happy snappers, yep, is that it has a decent amount of zoom, optical zoom, not digital zoom, because the digital zoom immediately loses all your quality of your image, whereas
the
optical zoom, if you've got more than you need, that's great. That means the image quality is going to stay nice and high.
Yeah.
And the GPS feature is wonderful for people that travel or for people that do work like you're doing out, surveying places or whatever.
It does a really good panorama photo that I think it's probably 120, 150 degrees.
Oh, yeah.
It actually takes it as a movie and then creates a still out of that at the end.
That's
you
clever.
Sort of just move the camera around in an arc fashion and it actually takes it like a movie, and then you've got your photo at the end of it. Whereas the old ones, you used to have to take a still and then it might give you something to match up to and you'd put it there and then, or you'd do it in post-processing software.
There's actually there's a website that'll stitch all your stills together for you into a panorama.
Yeah, this one. You don't
Microsoft tried doing that for a while. Well, too, didn't they? Silverlight or something.
But there is one warning though. Those cameras that have got the GPS feature on it, remember that it's on, and remember to turn it off if you're at home or somewhere where you sort of don't want people to necessarily be able to find you.
Yep. So and remember to wait a minute or two after you switch the camera on to get locked.
Good tip.
Yeah, but just bear the privacy concerns in mind as well.
Yeah. Guys, we're really running out of time this evening. Mark, thank you so much for coming in. And you
Thanks
can come in again
me.
Next week if you get a leave pass or you want to, because there's a lot more to talk about.
It's the last show of the year for us next week, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
It is. It's been good to have you back. If not, we'll definitely get you back in next year too from time to time, because we enjoy your chats. They're good.
We want to hear more about the wireless component of the NBN.
Absolutely.
We want regular updates.
Okay.
And we want to hear that 1 megabit per second figure up.
It's Lena's turn after this.
Listening to Australia's most informative technology show,
Tech Talk Radio.
I'm surprised they don't stand out the front healing lepers.
Trying to model these proteins takes a huge amount of computing power.
Looks like something Lady Gaga would wear.
I think a lot of people did give them shtick.
The boot up time is actually faster than the mobile phone 7 time.
Circuit switch networks, packet switch networks, two different things.
How do you kill it?
Put it in the washing machine.
Then Graham replied,
yes.
Doesn't like the way it looks congealed.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show,
Tech Talk Radio.
We're back. Hello, everybody.
You sound nervous.
No, I'm not nervous. It's just I've had a drink and all that sort of stuff. Come back refreshed.
Well, are you on the sauce?
Absolutely.
Not while you're on the radio.
Sharing is caring, by the way.
Well, there's a water fountain just out there, that door.
That's the hard stuff.
All that sort of stuff. Nothing, you know what it's like. It's radio, for goodness sake. So, you know. Anyway, it's very much come to that point in time where it's this person's turn.
Talk Games with Lena Van Deventer.
That's me. That name she just said. That's me.
It
I'm talking money tonight.
Really?
Yes. PlayStation Vita. Do you remember that? Or did we agree on Vita?
Vita.
Tornado. They're going to have a third swipe at purchasers' wallets. I'm a bit angry about this, actually. We talked about it probably 2 weeks ago when the release date and the launch day prices were revealed. And there was a bit of a shock about how much it would cost, especially considering it doesn't have a party piece like the 3D capabilities of the Nintendo 3DS. a short while after that, the publisher said that there would be a game transfer fee, where if you already owned a game on a PlayStation Portable device and wished to play it on the PlayStation Vita, you'd need to repurchase them at a discounted price.
Oh, Sony.
I'm a bit annoyed at that.
Go to Nintendo. Go to Xbox. Yeah. Go to anything but Sony.
I think I'm also a little bit annoyed.
Go to Sony. Go to Steam. Even with the credit card fiasco, it'll still cost you less.
We're being slugged again for a third time with the announcement of the prices for the proprietary memory cards. Now, listen to this.
I bet that's
the
a Sony thing. They do that.
The 32 gig memory card will cost $119.99. Almost half the price of the PlayStation Vita itself.
For how many gig?
32.
A 32 gig SD card in a funny shaped case.
Yep. $119.
Worth about $5 or $10 or something.
Yeah, certainly not worth $100 and whatever it is.
Nice. So that annoyed me a little bit.
It's a Sony.
Yep, that's what you get.
It's lonely. Yeah, it'll be the new one. It's lonely.
Thanks, Sony.
Stop doing it. Sony, stop it. George Miller has got something to say about games and money. The director of Mad Max and Happy Feet has said in a recent feature in the Financial Review that he could get Mad Max and Happy Feet. He could get two major games underway if the government passes a 40% tax rebate for game development, and that doing such would see an influx of filmmakers making their way to the games industry.
Stephen Conroy is in the back pocket to game presenters, developers at the moment because he wants them to develop for his NBN. High-speed games for medical purposes.
Well, he could do a lot more than he's doing.
What's the one with the... you chop the bananas up?
Fruit Ninja.
That's what they demonstrated on the NBN on Friday.
Yeah. We didn't pass your message on either, by the way.
No, you should have. I'm angry you didn't pass on my message.
Yeah, I think it constitutes unlawful assault.
Perhaps.
So we didn't pass the message on.
Unlawful is subjective.
You can... You might get the opportunity to pass it on yourself one day.
Excellent. Miller said people are drifting to games acquisition because of the budgets. A film may cost $170 million, twice that to market it, whereas the basic cost of making a game might be 10% of that. And he's not kidding. When you do the comparisons, the top four highest grossing video games over the first 5 days of release, Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3 was $775 million.
Wow.
That's a huge amount of money.
Good return on the investment.
Yeah, compare that to the first grossing movie over 5 days was The Dark Knight with $203 million.
Yeah, but you don't have actors' fees to pay, do you?
No, and there's also... That's the thing. It's a complicated figure to compare like that, and it's a bit simplified to do it that way because there are DVDs and all those sorts of other things to worry about and DLC, so it sort of balances itself out, but not really.
Lots of acronyms there. What does that mean?
That's right, you're only paying developers. You're not paying Hollywood talent.
Well, that's right.
That's right, and developers don't need real wages or working conditions or anything like that. No,
you settle, Graham.
Of course not. You can put them in a little cubicle and, give them a glass of water every 3 days and they'll be right. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I heard that Leonardo DiCaprio only comes out and does films starting at $7 million.
He hasn't won an Academy Award yet, so I don't think he's got the clout to ask for that kind
Well, there you go.
That kind of salary, but it's just me.
Did you say yet?
Yet, yes. I'm sure he'll
do
get
you know
one.
Something that we don't?
No, I don't have any insider knowledge, unfortunately. The Elder Scrolls Skyrim is estimated to top $240 million. That's insane. That's insane amount of monies. They sold 3.4 million copies at retail in its first 2 days. That's excluding digital sales, which I think the figure would be much, much larger if it had those figures as well. Bethesda issued in a statement that they'd shipped 7 million copies of the game and sold more than 50% of those in the first 48 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. Minecraft has sold 4 million copies.
Yay. All to Ron. Yep.
And me.
Oh,
I was playing before
50-50, huh?
I bought 2 million. Lena must have bought the other 2 million.
I did.
I can't believe you've built little railway carts on sky bridges and things.
Skyways. Yep,
skyways.
We've got skyways.
That's insane.
And I'm going to start building a roller coaster.
I've just worked out ladders.
Yeah.
I can build ladders.
Yeah, look, we know you play Minecraft. Let's move on, please.
Okay, sorry.
Graham doesn't like Minecraft.
Sorry.
We're going to have to get a nerd alert from computer alert.
Minecraft alert.
Minecraft alert. Yeah.
Yes, please. Can you dig it?
Yes, please.
Ha ha. And the Mario Kart 7 came out for the Nintendo 3DS today.
I got it. It's okay.
You're right.
Liar. You don't have a 3DS.
No, I got your Minecraft gag.
Oh, yes, you did.
He's on delay.
Thank you.
Mario Kart 7 for 3DS. Out today.
Out today. It introduced gliding and underwater driving, which would be quite interesting, I think. But yeah, that's me doing it quickly because we don't have much time left today.
No, that was very good, wasn't it?
I could go on, but
you could.
I won't.
Because I was going to talk about all sorts of things tonight, but I can't. Mm. Things like HP's touchpad shipments second to iPad. You know, that failed device that HP made? Yeah,
yes,
and
yes.
And they basically gave it away.
Running web OS.
Yeah, because they gave it away, it got close to iPad sales. So, you know, that's a choice.
By volume, not by revenue.
Yes, exactly, by default. So that was all good. And RIM can't, they can't give it away. Well, actually, they are. They're giving away playbooks to admins. I don't know what a playbook is, really. Have you seen or heard of what playbooks are? Are they...
They sound gamey.
They do, don't they? I'm sort of not quite... anyway,
I should look that up for next week, maybe.
Yeah.
All right, next week I'm going to do Christmas lists.
Christmas
lists,
yes.
Game Christmas lists.
We've got shopping websites and things like that we should be talking about too.
The Playbook's the RIM tablet.
There you go.
It's RIM's, the BlackBerry tablet, if you like.
Because you got a new tablet too the other day.
I did. I got a Kogan Agora tablet.
Yeah. Well, very good. How's it going on the sunlight? Let's ask you that. We looked at it the other day and forgot.
It's so-so, you know.
Yeah,
I guess.
So-so. The other interesting bit of news too this week, which is worth a mention, Telstra is issuing mobile alerts for voice and SMS now if you get very close to exceeding your limits and your plans and stuff like that. So, yes, some mobile customers will get it so they can not use excessive amounts and get bill shock, which everybody likes and loves.
Mobile alerts, like text messages.
Yeah. Yeah, like when you get close to your bandwidth usage. You know, at the moment, you know, you'll get a message from a company saying from Telstra I can speak from, you know, you've hit 80%, you know, you've hit 100%, call us to talk about it. and now they're going to do that for voice and SMS too.
Okay.
Because the youth of today love to send a text message, don't they?
Youth
of today. Yes. Haven't you noticed that? And so does Lena, but she
14-year-olds who can only communicate via their thumbs.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a social problem, isn't it?
Phil Rozelle in the chat just said, Playbook is the Nokia of tablets.
Oh, Phil. He's a cruel man,
Nokia
but fair.
Of tablets. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right, yes, Oddspot Gadget website of the week after this.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
Tech Talk Radio.
You should have seen the odd spot that Andrew sent me. That's with tone raised.
Sorry, Adelaide. Sorry, Brisbane. Sorry, Canberra.
Sorry, Darwin.
Oh, it'll get there in the end.
A question for Lena, gamer and mum.
Hey, that's me.
It's no good writing an agreement that's only enforceable in 1850.
Java, my friend. Java.
Yeah.
Could be Java.
Yeah.
Have you got a spare Google Plus invite? Yeah, it's in the mail.
Yay, my first nerd alert.
That's the first nerd alert.
It is.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! This thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my hole!
Thanks, TD, for this week's suggestion. The perfect Christmas gift for your wife, your girlfriend, your mum, or even yourself. The Nintendo Original Game Boy Dress.
Woo-hoo. I reckon we should get this for Lena. She'd look great in one of these.
This has been...
Have you seen it?
Totes. This has been made from soft grey knit and black fabric. It has buttons and a screen like a real Game Boy.
It has buttons.
Each
which
piece...
Which need being pressed, don't they?
Yes.
Where are the buttons?
There.
On your hips.
Okay. And you've got the little... What do you call a little joysticky thing you
the
move
D-pad.
With your thumb? That's it. That's on your other hip. Fits all shapes and sizes from extra small to extra large, each piece sewn on separately. It's about $78 and you can order online.
What a great idea. That's
www.etsy.com. You can go there and have a look at some photos too.
Very cool.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
Thank you, Amir, for this week's website. It's called Being Henry. HelloEvoke.com. Being Henry. I'll tell you, Graham. Hello, HELLO. Evoke, EVOQUE.com / Being Henry. I'll pop it in the show notes. I've never seen anything like this before, and Andrew had a look at it tonight too.
It's very good.
It's a choose-your-own-ending style interactive movie in a web browser. It's been professionally shot and produced.
Cool.
Amir says this incredible website is actually a movie you can watch, but this time you're the one who makes the decisions. Well, the idea is not totally new, but this is done in a very polished and professional way.
This is the trailer.
Jelly, sprinkles, they all represent a fork in the road of our lives we take. One fork ends is for you, and the other fork ends is for me.
Choices can be hard. So to make them easier, you're going to use this guy.
That's Henry.
And that's Henry, and that's who you are, isn't it?
But the disappointing part is it all turns out to be an ad for something, but...
Does it?
Yeah.
Aww. Did you get to the end, did you?
Oh.
Spoiler alert!
Sorry.
Graham!
I was going to say it's transmedia, but if it's an ad, it's not transmedia.
No, it's just an ad.
Yes.
It's very clever. It's very clever. You don't just like...
For an ad, it's very clever. I'll give you that.
You don't click like radio buttons to tell it what to do. You actually click and drag the characters in the movie. So
where do we go?
You go to HelloEvoque, so it's HelloEvoque.com tech.com/beinghenry.
Tech Talk Radio, app of the week.
WebKey for Android. Control your phone remotely from a web browser. People may ask why you'd want to control your phone from a web browser, but no, real geeks know better. If you can't think of why you'd want to have a remote control for a phone, then you probably don't need it, but for the rest of us, there's WebKey. WebKey allows you full control of your phone from any web browser, just as if it was in your hands, but it does more than this. With links in the web interface to send and read texts, view call logs, see the phone's location on a map, browse the onboard and SD card storage, and
it needs to be jailbreak, doesn't it?
Even send commands via terminal. You do need root access to your phone for WebKey to be installed.
Not hard.
But if you're the sort of person that thinks WebKey is a good idea, maybe you've already got root access to your phone.
Yep.
4.5 stars. It's free in the Android market. WebKey for Android.
Can you dig it?
No, ma'am. We're musicians.
Ma, the meatloaf!
Bond. James Bond.
You can't handle the truth!
And the hits just keep on coming.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Graham's mum, block your ears for 30 seconds.
This is the one I wanted last week, which he disappointed me on.
Andrew made me do it, Graham.
I did not. He just found it.
Adult movie studio, ooh. Vivid Entertainment, wants HTC to change the name of one of its smartphones, HTC Vivid, as it fears users might think the two are somehow connected.
Ew.
Vivid Entertainment has sent HTC a cease and desist letter threatening legal action if HTC does not change the name of the smartphone. By the 21st of November.
That come on, guys. Come on, guys. There's some fantastic marketing opportunities here.
There is, actually.
While it's a bit far-fetched to believe consumers would confuse a smartphone with a porn studio, it's true that Vivid offers content through a variety of digital channels, including smartphones. HTC didn't comment on the matter.
I have come to jailbreak the phone.
Yeah.
Bow, wow. Wow.
Hey, Warlock.
Hey, how you doing?
Yeah, good.
There's Warlock.
Hey, there's a Warlock.
There's Warlock. Thanks for joining us tonight. It's been great.
A voice from far away. Yeah. I hope you really liked everything that I had to say.
Yeah, it was great. Can we get you back next week for the last show?
No worries.
That'd be really, really good. Join us on the Skype then. So, the planets did finally align towards the end of the show. Don't know what it was. Well, I do.
Had a technical issue.
Yeah, some Bluetooth device had hijacked my laptop. I don't know quite what was going on there. But anyway, we got to the end of it. Next week is our last show for 2011. Before we go on summer holidays, which is going to be good.
No, we haven't just done a whole year of Tech Talk Radio, have we?
Yeah, just like that.
We're coming back next year?
I don't know. Do you want to?
We'll talk about it.
We'll talk about it next week. Okay, excellent. So be sure to tune in on the same radio station you're listening to now for our final show for 2011. Great Christmas tips, some good shopping websites coming up and all sorts of stuff. So make sure you come and join us on the chat. And drinkies, Dr. Ron?
Yes, drinkies. Don't forget, put this in your calendar. Friday the 9th of December at the Elgin in Hawthorne.
Chin chin.
6:30 p.m.
That's our local.
Is that on the website somewhere?
It is on the website somewhere. It will be very soon.
I better put it on.
Okay.
If you subscribe to our email newsletter, you'll have all the details in the email newsletter.
You will indeed. Make sure you subscribe. Bang the rocks together, guys. Thank you to Mark Diggins for coming in this evening, ex-panelist and future panelist and panelist all round. And also Robert Broomhead from the Wireless Institute of Australia to give you your tasks to do over the Christmas period. You can go and get your foundation license.
Get your foundation class.
Absolutely.
Licenses.
It's good fun. Ham Radio is great. Everyone should be in it, shouldn't they, Lena?
Yes.
You'd do it, wouldn't you?
Totes.
Warlock says 73s.
73s, absolutely. All right, so until our last show, which is coming up next week. It's been fun tonight. Same time next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, regular panellists Graham Callaghan, Mark Diggins and Lena Van Deventer. Expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by GC Support and Shaq West. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC in Melbourne. The crew wish to thank all the stations around Australia and around the world that broadcast the show. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. Contact us for the two-hour version or access the one-hour show on the Community Radio Network. Visit cbaa.org.au for further details. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03-8682-9099 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, for more information. Don't forget, you can follow the panellists on Twitter, join us live each Monday night in the Tech Talk Radio chat, and solve your issues on the Tech Talk Radio forum. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.